Words are powerful. Use the word terrorist in this post-9/11 world, and you can feel the nervous heaviness of it as it comes out of your mouth. When you're labeled a terrorist, that nervous heaviness imbued with fear surrounds you, making you an easy political target. This is a situation increasingly facing activists of all stripes. Animal rights activists, well known for their underground tactics and action, are one group being specifically targeted. That link between animal rights activism and terrorism was sealed into law in the United States when the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act was passed back in 2006. Many are raising the alarm bells about this issue. The New York-based Center for Constitutional Rights argue that this act is creating a chilling effect and sets a dangerous precedent. Matthew Strugar is a lawyer working with the Center for Constitutional Rights. He has defended a number of animal rights activists who have faced charges under this act, as well as its predecessor, the Animal Enterprise Protection Act. We've reached Matthew at his home in Los Angeles, California. Thanks for joining us, Matthew.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit about the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. How did it come to be?
Well, like many of these laws aimed at protecting corporate interests, they were pushed through by the corporate lobby here in America. There was a law that had been on the books since the mid-90s, and I think it was even in the mid-90s it was in response to underground animal rights activists like the ALS. There was a law on the books called the Animal Enterprise Protection Act. And the Animal Enterprise Protection Act was not quite as scary, at least on the books and its text, as the Animal Enterprise Protection Act. And that just said, you know, you can't go in and should you go in and break property or liberate animals that are considered property of a corporation or of an animal enterprise, there are certain penalties. And the penalties weren't that great, and it only applied for actions taken against the animal enterprise itself. So it was specifically targeting animal rights activists, but it wasn't quite as alarming as the current version. Then a group of activists known as the Stop Huntington Animal Cruelty, which are active here in the United States and in England, started doing a lot of secondary and tertiary targeting. And secondary and tertiary targeting involves going after services and corporations, third parties who contract with your target. So for the Stop Huntington Animal Cruelty campaign, their target was Huntington Life Sciences, a vivisector who had been, animal testing organization that had been infiltrated many times, and their very horrific, animal abuse practices have been documented time and again. So unable to sort of shut Huntington down by targeting Huntington themselves, they went after people that Huntington needed, but that didn't need Huntington. So say their janitorial services or the places that catered for them or their banks and all sorts of companies that contracted with them but didn't need Huntington, to their business with Huntington to sort of stay alive. So they started going after these other organizations, and they started cutting ties to Huntington quickly. And called the Shack activists, Stop Huntington Animal Cruelty. The Shack activists were able to sort of bring Huntington to its knees. They got delisted from the New York Stock Exchange because they pushed their stock price under a dollar. And that's when folks in the corporate animal, enterprise lobby, or whatever you want to call it, started really pushing for this Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. And what the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act does is it ramps up the penalties for folks who are, convicted or charged with causing damage to an animal enterprise. It expands a lot of the definitions to include an animal enterprise includes anybody that does business with an animal enterprise, so it specifically goes after a secondary and tertiary targeting. And most scary, at least constitutionally, is that it has language in there that it prohibits damage to an animal enterprise, which is all fine and good until you start reading the definitions, the specific definitions in the bill. And it says that damage includes any action that leads to a loss of profit for the animal enterprise or that can lead to increased security costs. And, the real fear there is that you do a lawful boycott, you have a picket outside a fur store, and if they, put an extra lock on their door, or they hire a security guard to help people, get through the picket to get in the door, or they, even if they claim that they lose profits, they lose, business, you could be charged under this, you know, what is actually, at least in name, a federal act of terrorism. So the law hasn't quite been used that way yet, but the actual statute, the language of it certainly allows for that.
It sounds like there's a lot going on there. I'm just curious if you can talk a little bit more about who is lobbying for this bill. So you mentioned those some of those big corporate interests. Who can you just spell it a little bit more briefly? Who those interests are?
Sure. I mean, I think and it's not totally clear, at least to me, who they all are, but certainly the main players in animal experimentation and the people really scared and the people with a lot of money here is Big Pharma. GlaxoSmithKline and Pfizer and organizations like that were certainly, part of the consortium behind pushing this bill. You know, they do what a lot of corporations, they did in this case, what a lot of corporations do is where they form these, umbrella organizations where their membership is secret, so you don't really know who's behind it, and then they have some, nice name like Center for Consumer Freedom or something like that, that sounds sort of innocuous, but is really really a front organization for a corporate conglomerate. So it's hard to say exactly who's behind it, but certainly, the people with the most to lose here are, Big Pharma and their subsidiaries.
And so I'm curious as to, are not all the things sort of spelled out in this bill already illegal? Why the need, other than, satisfying these lobby groups to make more specific laws around things that already sound like they would be illegal? Or does it expand the definition of what is illegal?
Well, we argued to a judge in one of these cases that it certainly does expand, what is illegal, to say that causing lost profits to an animal enterprise or, having increased security costs to an animal enterprise constitutes economic damage or constitutes damage. But I think the broader point is right, that if this really was aimed simply at, say, property destruction or there's also a provision about, threats of serious bodily harm or death, if you threaten somebody, I'm going to kill you for whatever, certainly that's already illegal. I think the aim of this bill was to both ramp up the penalties for those violations, to sort of federalize them. In the states we have state crimes, which could be if you throw yourself down in front of a first door, you get like a obstruction charge or disorderly conduct or something that's going to carry 2-6 months something max. So they take what would once be state law crimes, they federalize them, they ramp up the penalties, and sort of to send a message to animal rights activists, like, all right, if anybody else does this, they're not going to, be looking at as much, but if you do it, it's going to be a lot more time. And I think the other point of it, even if they didn't increase all the penalties, is to attach the T word, to start being able to throw around, these are eco-terrorists, these are animal rights terrorists, this is terrorism, this is Al-Qaeda sort of, thing. So I think the purpose is sort of dual in that, we get greater penalties and we get to really sort of fearmonger around this kind of stuff.
Because I know the FBI called eco-terrorism and animal rights activism in that context the number one domestic terror threat. What do you think about that?
Well, if only those were the only domestic terror problems in the United States, were the animal rights kids and the environmental activists, who in the United States at least have never, caused the death of a human being, in the history of those movements here in the United States. We have white nationalist groups. We have the radical pro-life movement that has been murdering doctors for decades and, just recently in the last year. But it's the corporate interests that really run the show in this country and in, many countries. And the activists that really are, threatening sort of the corporate American way of life aren't, the radical abortion activists or the white supremacists. They're just the ones terrorizing real people. The people who are really aiming at the corporate bottom line are the animal rights activists and the environmentalists. And I think that's why that FBI I think he's the chief of domestic terrorism. I forget his exact title, but I think that's why in his congressional testimony he identified those two movements as the number one domestic terrorist threat in the United States.
So that's part of the reason why they're probably targeting animal rights activists opposed to another kind of sort of group of activists.
I think so. I mean, I'm not gonna you know say that the FBI lets white nationalists or the anti-abortion, you know, the people murdering abortion doctors off. It's not sort of a conspiracy theory, but I think there is a definite emphasis and a fear-mongering around animal rights and environmental activists that you don't see against other movements. And there are indictments against animal rights and environmental activists and sentences and the government seeking penalties that are far and away greater than they are against sort of other out there American political movements.
Because I know you've worked on a couple of cases. You were talking a little bit about the Shack. There's a case known as the Shack 7 that you worked on. Can you tell us a little bit more about the case and who this Shack 7 are?
Yeah, so the Shack 7, or there's six individuals in the corporation itself, the Shack USA. And these are the individuals that were doing the organizing against Huntington Life Sciences. And their organization is called Stop Huntington Animal Cruelty, and it's where the Shack moniker comes from. And what Shack was basically a website and a limited amount of organizing. Shack USA had a website where they posted all the activity that was going on against Shack or the Shack-related targeted companies. And they also organized and publicized home demonstrations of executives and other folks' homes. You know, the people go and they chant outside the homes and they put up flyers saying, you know, this, you know, executive XYZ kills puppies, he's a murderer. But Shack also had a portion of their website that was dedicated to direct action, and on the website they would accept anonymous communiques where anyone could sort of write in and say, you know, what action they had taken, you know, the underground activity as well as the above ground activity that they had taken against Huntington Life Sciences or any of the subsidiary corporations. So there was, and they had no editorial policy. They sort of, anything that came through, they didn't even verify whether it was true. They just put it up. So there was a whole lot of illegal underground activity taking place against Huntington Life Sciences. Some folks sank the CEO's yacht. They etched slogans in his golf course. People firebombed cars. Lots of windows were broken. Things like that, mostly. No one in the Shack campaign, at least in America, someone did in England, but no one in the Shack campaign in America was ever injured, even by these anonymous underground activists. And the Shack website had sort of publicized these things, and that they would sometimes throw in a line or two editorializing it that their lawyers talked about as kind of like Nelson from The Simpsons, just sort of like pointing and laughing, like ha ha, like not sort of a we didn't do it but we dug it kind of thing. And Shack was eventually, the website and the six individuals who were involved in running the campaign were indicted for interstate stalking, for animal enterprise, a violation of the Animal Enterprise Protection Act, the predecessor of the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, and some various like wiretapping statutes, because they also encouraged people to send black faxes, where you take a couple pieces of black paper and you run them through a fax machine and you just fax people, black paper so it runs out their toner. It's a pretty crude and, not too destructive way of, bringing down the bottom line. But they were indicted and convicted of stalking, and pretty much what the government said was, Shack knew that the folks who were the targets, who are these corporations, who worked for these corporations, would be checking the Shack website, and they purposefully put up these kinds of activities, what was going on, with the purpose of threatening them, with bodily injury. So they put it up, and they said, this is different than just a newspaper that reports on these kinds of things, because these kids like it, and they want to encourage it. And they just put, you know, it's the problem with putting marginalized activists in front of a jury is they put them up there and they said, you know, these kids are weird. These kids are unlike you and me. And they were convicted in a, an appeals court just recently upheld their conviction. And three of them are still doing some time. They got sentences between 1 and 7 years.
Wow, just for running that website. So what do you think the implications of that case are?
Well, it's hard to say. I'm surprised that the sort of American First Amendment media hasn't picked up on the case a lot more. CCR's involvement was, the Center for Constitutional Rights, my employer, their involvement is more on the First Amendment issues. We're amicus, which means we wrote as a friend of the court saying, listen, these are very serious First Amendment issues. You know, consider this in your ruling. And I'm surprised the rest of the First Amendment world hasn't sort of picked up on this case and said, you know, this is a very dangerous precedent if we allow people to go to jail for 7 years just for running a website that says, you know, we think it's funny that the CEO's yacht was sunk, and we think we encourage other people to do the same. You know, there's serious implications for all sorts of speech out there in America that encourages, you know, civil disobedience of any kind, whether it just be, you know, locking yourself down in front of a store or, you know, something more radical like sinking a yacht. So it's hard to know where it's really going to go. With the lawyers are planning on appealing to the full, you know, the one-step review before the Supreme Court and then to the Supreme Court if necessary. And the Center for Constitutional Rights is planning on filing briefs all along the way saying, you know, we think the court should take this issue up and reverse the previous decision. But, you know, it's hard to say what our chances are with that.
So the Shack 7 were charged under the predecessor to the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, which was called the Animal Enterprise Protection Act. And now I know you're working on another case where people have actually been charged under this new act. What's that case all about?
Right. Well, first, it's interesting to note that when Congress passed the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, they did it specifically in response to the Shack activists. I mean, they said, you know, we need protection from these secondary and tertiary targeting, and we need to be able to go after people with much harsher penalties than we had previously. So the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act was passed in 2006 in response to the Shack campaign and the Shack activists. And it's just sort of laid dormant. The government hadn't really used it for, you know, almost 3 years. But in, I believe it was March, there were four individuals up in Northern California between like Santa Cruz and Berkeley who were indicted for what essentially is four home demonstrations or four, you know, speech acts under the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. And they were, the charges come out of a series of home demonstrations and flyers. And at the home demonstrations, the government alleges that the chants that the activists used were, you know, overly threatening. I'm sorry, is this something, can I curse on the air if I talk about the chants?
Yes, you can curse on the air.
Okay.
All in good context.
Don't know what the rules are up there in Canada. I know I couldn't down here. The chants include, you know, what's popular at animal rights protests, that chant that goes, what goes around comes around, burn the fucker to the ground. And the government, you know, alleges that chant in and of itself is a threat of arson and a threat of bodily injury, and that it's not, you know, hyperbole and it's not just sort of political rhetoric, but that it's an actual threat of arson to someone's home. So there were a number of different home demonstrations where folks, including these four activists, allegedly were attending and used those chants. And then there were some flyers made in Santa Cruz that said, I believe the text of the flyer was allegedly murderers and torturers alive in your neighborhood, with you know, a description of the activities of some primate researchers at the University of Berkeley. I'm sorry, this all arises out of a primate research campaign against primate research at the University of California University System. And the flyer said, "More murders and tortures alive in your neighborhood," a description of their activities, and then listed their names, home phone numbers, and addresses. And, in, you know, whether in connection with those flyers or not, or just part of the campaign generally, some of those researchers were targeted by underground activists with, you know, window breaking, and I think some cars were set on fire and some things like that. So these four individuals were charged, and there's no allegations that they were involved in the arsons or that they were involved in any of the underground activity, but the charges are basically that the chants and the flyers were, you know, threats of serious bodily harm or injury, and they're facing, I think it's 10 years if convicted on all charges.
So this sounds like it would have a really sort of chilling effect on how people express their, you know, outrage or whatever issue they're working on, particularly animal rights activism, but I think across the board.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's exactly what the government's going for.
Right, trying to scare people, basically. And also, I think, what about this whole, connecting it to terror, this whole concept of terrorism? How do you think that impacts?
Just the word itself is gonna scare a lot of people from, you know, we talk to people in this movement and in other movements who say, you know, just being able to, just throwing that word around is going to scare people, for they're afraid to come out to protest, they're afraid they're going to be, you know, put on some terrorist watch list just because of this law exists. You have environmental activists like Daniel McGowan and other folks here in the United States who were charged with a couple of politically motivated arsons where no one was hurt, who got, federal terrorism enhancements, which are usually, you know, reserved for, you know, originally were passed for things like hijacking airplanes and whatnot, charged with terrorism enhancements because they issued communiques after the arsons saying that, you know, that the arsons were in response to prologging legislation and things like that. So you have folks who would normally be getting, you know, a 7-year arson charge in the U.S. typically facing life plus 166 years because of these terrorism enhancements. So it's you know, it's across movements, and it's certainly the word is thrown out there. And it's a calculated move to scare people.
Yeah, it sounds like even though it's in the American context, it sort of crosses borders, and we have our own particular issues up here, but even things there are impacting people here. So I know there's a lot more to talk about with that, but unfortunately we've run out of time. I just wanted to thank you so much for helping us explore some of that, and I imagine you'll continue to struggle with those cases and try and defend those people who have been charged.
I hope so, and thanks a lot for having me on. I enjoy talking about it.
We have been talking to Matthew Strugar. He's a lawyer working with the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York, and he's defended a number of animal rights activists who face charges under the 2006 U.S. Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. And so for more information on the act and the center's work, you can check their website. It's ccrjustice.org. That's ccrjustice.org. And for more information on the broader issues of criminalizing environmental activism, you can check out the website greenisthenewred.com. That's www.greenisthenewred.com.